Chapter 3. The Carver Family Hatchet Murders, 1930. On the afternoon of April 2nd, 1930, Lottie Altsmeyer was resting on her bed, ready to drift off into a peaceful nap. It was a beautiful Wednesday, with temperature-perfect weather near Sebring, Florida. The orange trees were in full bloom, proudly displaying their five-starred blossoms. Their scent blended with the breeze that flowed through the open window into Lottie's room. The 26-year-old housewife had just closed her eyes when she heard two loud bangs coming from her neighbor's house. Pulled back from the edge of sleep, she rolled over to face the window and opened her eyes. The eerie silence was broken by two soul-piercing screams. That got her out of bed, and as she stood by the window, looking over at the Spanish-style bungalow the Carver family had recently moved into, she heard four more gunshots that instinctively made her jerk back. Whatever was going on over there, she knew it was really bad. Anxious and afraid, she tried to calm her one-year-old son, Richard, who had just started crying in his crib. She was stroking his forehead when her mother-in-law walked into the bedroom to check on Lottie and her grandson. As the two women debated whether they should call the police or go next door, their telephone rang. It was the neighbor, William Carver. "There's been a terrible accident with his wife and son," he said, "and he wanted her to come over. He had already telephoned police and called for a doctor, but it would be a little while for word to reach them." Down the street, in the opposite direction of the Altsmeyer home, Neil Cash had just finished changing a tire on his truck when he heard four gunshots. He stopped to look in the direction of the home the Carvers were renting from his friend, Tom Mitchell. Just as he turned his attention back to putting his tools away, he heard three loud screams followed by a short pause, and then two more gunshots. The 38-year-old started his truck and drove 150 yards to the house, where he stopped, jumped out, looked through the living room window, and then ran inside through the front door without bothering to knock or call out. After crossing the living room to the dining room, Cash found Ben Whitehead, the Carver's black chore man, lying on his back near the bathroom door. There was a bullet hole just above his right eye, and, judging by his empty stare at the ceiling, Cash knew he was dead. Alerted by the agony-tempered groans of a woman in the room to his right, Cash slowly pushed open the bedroom door and saw William's wife, Ruth, on the floor in front of the bed. Her head was covered in blood, and she was thrashing from side to side, moaning in pain. Her young son, lying next to her, was also covered in blood and wasn't moving. From the quick scan he gave the room, he understood two things. Mrs. Carver's injuries were too severe for him to be of much help, and there was an alarming amount of blood covering both the woman and her son. As Cash hopped in his truck and drove away to get help, Lottie Altsmeyer had finished getting dressed and ran toward the Carver's patio door on the opposite side of the house. Mr. Carver was standing there waiting for her. In an almost hysterical voice, he sobbed out a brief story of what had happened. Her initial fears were right. It was really bad. Their chore man, Ben Whitehead, had bludgeoned his wife and son with something in his hand, and then Carver had shot Whitehead as he was coming after him. Fighting to catch his breath, Lottie couldn't help but notice bloodstains on both the front and back of Mr. Carver's white shirt. Standing just 5'4", her short, stocky neighbor guided her from the laundry room to his bedroom, where he pointed down a narrow hallway leading to the bathroom and master bedroom. Without saying a word, he followed behind as she ventured forward and discovered first Whitehead near the bathroom, and then Mrs. Carver and her young son on the floor in the adjacent bedroom. Although a towel was wrapped around the boy's head, she observed that nothing had been done for Mrs. Carver, who rolled back and forth with her arm occasionally swinging up into the air. "What can we do?" Lottie reportedly asked Carver in that moment. Slow to respond, with a mind that was overloaded, Carver told her to call for a doctor, forgetting that he had already done so. The telephone operator informed Lottie that they were doing everything they could to get help to the Carvers' home. In that first bedroom she had come to, 11-month-old Frances was crying loudly, scared by all the noise. Lottie picked her up and comforted the child as she looked around for Mr. Carver. She found him standing over the kitchen sink, splashing water on his face and neck, and then washing his hands and arms. Two telephone company linemen working nearby also heard the shots and entered the house just as Mr. Carver was washing. As he dried his hands on a towel, Carver gave a brief explanation of the tragedy to Ray Morgan and Paul Serginier, who helped him remove his blood-stained shirt as he spoke. The chore man and Carver's son were both dead, and the man's poor wife was in the bedroom alone, probably dying. And just as Lottie had, Morgan and Serginier realized there was nothing they could do but wait for the authorities to arrive to help a family that nobody in Highlands County, Florida, really knew. William Raymond Carver was born in 1891 in Philadelphia, where his father was a successful steel manufacturer. Ray, as he liked to be called, graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 1912 with a bachelor's degree in economics. He then took graduate courses at the University of Pennsylvania, Columbia University, and Harvard. During the Great War, he was called up and served with distinction as an ammunition supply officer. When he returned home after the war, Ray worked with his father, Samuel Carver, who had become a successful real estate developer in South Florida. Although his passion was to be a writer, Ray knew financial success was more attainable if he followed in his father's footsteps. In 1919, he returned to Pennsylvania to start his own real estate ventures. While there, he met his future wife. Following a one-year courtship, William Ray Carver married Ruth Staff near Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania in 1920. Ruth was a tender-hearted young woman from a proud family who were impressed with Ray's devotion to her. And like most mothers and daughters do, the two confided in each other, and Ruth only had good things to say about her husband. Family and friends would later report their marriage was one of the happiest they had ever seen. As a real estate speculator using his father's money, Carver moved his family around a lot during the first 10 years of his marriage, buying and selling land in Pennsylvania, California, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. In between these deals, Ray and Ruth would spend summers with her mother in the Pocono Mountains or with his father in South Florida. Samuel Carver made a lot of money during the 1920s Florida real estate boom and was one of the few who survived the bust relatively unscathed. His success and foresight allowed him to purchase Villa Serena, a beautiful home once owned by 3-time presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan. He was also able to negotiate a good price for 5,000 acres of land 170 miles north near Sebring and Lake Jackson in Highlands County. His plan was to build a subdivision of single-family homes there under the supervision of his son. To be near the large-scale venture, the younger Carver found a comfortable Spanish-style home for rent 3 miles outside of Sebring and moved his family in during the first week of February 1930. As their housing development project slowly got underway, Ray Carver enjoyed an easygoing lifestyle that allowed him to golf nearly every morning. But as he stood there in the dining room with his neighbor's wife and two men he didn't know, the events of the last 20 minutes barely seemed comprehensible. When Sebring Police Chief Richard Stuyvesant and Dr. John Mitchell arrived, their immediate focus was on all three victims. Whitehead and the Carver's little boy were clearly dead, and Ruth Carver was slipping away fast. As he knelt beside her, Dr. Mitchell watched helplessly as Ruth Carver let out one last painful moan before she too died. Chief Stuyvesant looked around at the carnage in the bedroom, gathered it all in, and then walked into the living room to talk to the husband. Highlands County Sheriff Oscar Wolfe and the former sheriff, James Hancock, were in the living room when Chief Stuyvesant asked the dead woman's husband for an explanation. According to Ray Carver's story, he arrived home at noon after playing a round of golf that morning. After they ate lunch, all four members of the Carver family lay down to take a nap. His wife Ruth and their 2-year-old son, Lee Townsend, went to sleep in one bedroom, while Ray and his 11-month-old daughter, Frances, rested in another room. The two bedrooms were separated by a bathroom and a closet, with a hallway connecting all four rooms. Ray instructed Ben Whitehead to wash the dishes and then mop the kitchen and bathroom floors, but to do so quietly. Shortly after drifting off to sleep, he was awakened by his wife's screams a little after 2 p.m. "I got up and went to her room and saw my wife and my little boy on the floor," an emotionally charged Carver told the lawman. "Whitehead turned and started for me. I had no weapon. He had something in his hand. I didn't know what it was, but I knew he was after me. I knew he'd done something to my wife, and I had to get a gun. I ran back to my room and got a gun. I fired at the dirty skunk. I kept on firing until my gun stopped firing. I got more cartridges and put them in. Whitehead raised his head and shoulders from the floor, and I fired again and again." Whitehead was walking backward toward the bathroom when he was shot, Carver explained. And despite firing 6 bullets at him at point-blank range, Whitehead was only hit twice. When they looked around for a motive to explain why Whitehead would murder Ruth Carver and her son, the lawmen found their answer in the small pile of jewelry that was gathered together on top of a vanity. In Whitehead's back pocket, they found a white beaded necklace and a small jewelry box. Chief Stuyvesant and Sheriff Wolf surmised that Ruth had woken up from her nap to see Whitehead stealing her jewelry, which caused her to scream. Instead of running out of the house through an exterior door in that same bedroom, Whitehead responded by bludgeoning Ruth and Lee to death with a hatchet covered by a golf club sock. The cutting edge was fairly clean, but the blunt edge was soaked with blood. During a coroner's hearing that was assembled a few hours later at 5 p.m., Ray Carver told the same story he had told police. After Dr. Mitchell examined the bodies at a local morgue, he testified that the 34-year-old mother of two had bled to death from 5 deep gashes to her cerebrum. The wounds were inflicted behind Ruth's right ear and were administered by the hatchet covered with a golf club stocking. 3 of the 5 wounds were caused by the blunt edge and 2 by the cutting edge. Dr. Mitchell also told the coroner's jury that when he found her, Ruth Carver was lying on her back with her left arm at the side and the right arm extended. Her head was twisted to one side, and there was a slight wound on the cheek in front of her right ear. Ray's 2-year-old son, Lee, was struck by 2 blows behind the right ear, the same location as his mother's wounds. There were no bullet wounds to either Ruth or her son. The coroner's jury concluded that Ruth and her son were murdered by Ben Whitehead, and that Whitehead was then shot to death by Mr. Carver. His killing was ruled justifiable homicide. Although they came to their decision swiftly, and some members of local law enforcement considered it an open-and-shut case, there was one man who thought things were moving too fast. He wanted to take a second look for himself. Grady Burton was a young, aggressive prosecuting attorney for the 19th Judicial Circuit, which held Highlands County within its boundaries. 36 hours after the incident, he met with Sheriff Wolf and Chief Stuyvesant, who walked him through the crime scene. With Carver's story as his initial guide, Burton found it strange that Whitehead was found on his back with 2 gunshot wounds, either of which would have been fatal. Burton decided this single peculiarity was enough for him to dig into the incident more thoroughly. "I wasn't satisfied that a person shot through the head and heart would fall on his back," Burton wrote in a 1932 magazine article. "I felt this point should be cleared up, and it started me upon an investigation that was to continue through several hours of intensive effort and study." If Whitehead did in fact assault Ruth and Lee Carver in the bedroom where blood spatter was found on the floor, walls, ceiling, and furniture, Then why was there more blood on Mr. Carver than there was on Ben Whitehead? The only bloodstains found on the 32-year-old laborer were from his own bullet wounds. With the exception of the jewelry in his back pocket, there was no evidence Whitehead was even in Ruth's bedroom. By contrast, Lottie Alsmeyer and the two telephone company employees reported that Carver's shirt had bloodstains on both the front and the back. The back of the shirt was crimson-stained in several places, especially between the shoulders, Burton wrote. The stains bore out their statements. The end of the golf stocking, which covered the hatchet, was also covered with stains. What the state attorney was getting at in his article, without saying it directly, is that he believed those stains on the back of Carver's shirt likely came from raising the covered hatchet up to bring it down for each blow to the head of his wife and child. After Sir Junior helped Mr. Carver remove his shirt, that key piece of evidence was lost to investigators. Lottie's husband, Louis Alsmeyer, took the shirt home and put it in a pot of cold water to lift the fresh blood stains out of it. He did so without any intent to destroy evidence, Burton asserted. He had found the shirt in Carver's home while helping to clear away traces of the horrible tragedy. Deciding it was a good shirt, he took it home and put it in the pot preparatory to having it washed. When Sheriff Wolf later examined the golf knickers Carver was wearing that Wednesday afternoon, Burton learned he had found spots that looked like blood spots that had been washed off. When Mrs. Alsmeyer and the telephone lineman told the prosecutor they saw Mr. Carver washing up over the kitchen sink, it only added to his suspicions. News of the tragedy traveled fast, and two local newspaper reporters arrived at the house shortly after local law enforcement appeared. One of those reporters was snooping around when he discovered a $10,000 life insurance policy on Ruth Carver. He also found a golf club stocking under the kitchen sink, which matched the one that covered the hatchet. The policy had been taken out 4 months earlier and named her husband and children as beneficiaries. Like many life insurance policies, Ruth's paid double in case of accidental or violent death. Chief Stuyvesant told Burton that, while questioning everyone who was there that afternoon, he had heard Carver crying, "My God, I'm sorry I did it. Why did I do it?" This was later confirmed by one of the newspaper reporters who was in the house when it was said. When Burton tried to question the widowed husband about the incident and get clarification on some of the issues raised by witnesses, Burton felt that Carver was evasive with his answers. "He was reluctant to talk and appeared to dislike being questioned about the matter," Burton wrote in his magazine article. "He offered us little encouragement and seemed satisfied to let the matter rest as it stood." Although he found circumstantial evidence which directed suspicion at Ray Carver, Burton also learned that on the morning of the day she was killed, Ruth Carver had been chatting outside with Lottie's father-in-law and had told him, "I'm afraid of that Negro." Whitehead, who was working in a flower bed at the time, was staring directly at her while she spoke. Emmanuel Alsmeyer also told Burton that Mrs. Carver appeared extremely nervous that morning. Weighing this new evidence in his mind, the 36-year-old prosecutor had William Raymond Carver arrested, and Burton called for a new coroner's hearing. "Admittedly," he would later write, "the evidence I had at that time did not fully justify it." In spite of this, Burton presented his circumstantial evidence, and the case was recommended to a grand jury, which charged William Carver with all three murders. "We are going clear to the bottom of this case in order to uncover every angle," Burton boldly announced to the press while the grand jury toured the Carver's rented home. As soon as Carver was indicted, news of the tragedy and his arrest exploded onto the front pages of newspapers nationwide. Reporters from New York, Pennsylvania, and all corners of Florida invaded quiet little Sebring to cover one of the most sensational murder cases the Sunshine State had ever seen. It was a high-profile crime that had all the ingredients of a sensation-driven story. Racial tension, a defendant from a wealthy family with good social standing, an innocent wife and mother brutally murdered with her baby son by a hatchet, a dead black man who may or may not have been the perpetrator, and circumstantial evidence that failed to conclusively answer if Carver was guilty or not, which only deepened the mystery. Everyone who followed the case had an opinion, and they weren't shy about expressing it either. I estimate that I received approximately 10,000 letters, Burton wrote in 1932. Some of them praised me for my efforts. Others offered advice and suggestions. Several hundred severely criticized me for having this man sent to jail and placed on trial. A few threatened me should I continue the case. Because Circuit Court Judge William Barker was named in news reports as the presiding judge, he received a similar number of letters with the same mixture of sentiments. When Ruth's mother and brother arrived in Sebring, not long after Carver was indicted, there was no confusion over their opinion. Julius Staff and his mother, Marie Staff Boardman, stood firmly behind Ray. After visiting her son-in-law in jail, Ruth's mother scoffed at the guilty or not questions reporters lobbed at her. I spent 2 winters with my daughter and her husband, and there was nothing but harmony in their married life, Marie told reporters. He was a devoted husband and father and a wonderful son-in-law to me. If I thought there was one little inharmonious thing in their lives, I would be the first one to tell about it because I would want my daughter's death avenged. Carver's brother-in-law also had strong words of support. It is foolish to even think that he could have committed such a crime, Julius Staff declared to reporters. He had known Ray for 10 years and described him as a devoted and loyal husband. When reporters were allowed into the jail to interview him, Carver held the same indignation over his arrest as his in-laws. This is ridiculous. They ought to know better, he told them. How can anyone think that I could have done it? For his son's defense, Samuel Carver hired Walter Bell, a state senator and former judge, and Mitchell Price, another defense lawyer who once served as a judge before going into private practice. Their first task was to file a writ of habeas corpus to push back against a no-bail order and then free their client on a $15,000 bond. At Carver's preliminary hearing, Bell and Mitchell sought to get the charges dropped but were unsuccessful. They then requested a 30-day extension to the start of trial, a move that Burton opposed. Unlike his own attorneys, Carver wanted a speedy trial without delay so he could get back to his life and care for his remaining daughter. The state of Florida versus William Raymond Carver began on May 12th, just 40 days after the killings. The small courthouse in Sebring was packed every day of the trial with courtroom gawkers who came from all over the country. Those lucky enough to get a seat brought a sack lunch so they wouldn't lose their coveted place during the noon recess. As part of his strategy to get a conviction, Burton tried Carver only for the murder of his wife. He knew jurors might acquit him of killing a black man, and for his son there was no apparent motive. But for Ruth, the defendant had a $10,000 motive with double indemnity. Her family disagreed, and their support of William had not wavered. Ruth's mother and brother were there every day, alongside his own parents and younger brother, Roy. It was a strong show of support noted by newspaper reporters who covered the trial. Carver, surrounded by relatives of himself and his wife, sat through the morning session with his eyes fixed on the floor, his lips nervously twitching, with little to say to those about him, the Associated Press reported. After 2 days devoted to selecting a jury, Burton was blunt when he told those 10 men his case was built around circumstantial evidence. He opened with Dr. Mitchell's account of the crime scene as he had found it that fateful afternoon. As the doctor directed the jury's attention to an architectural diagram of the house, the prosecutor saw that this was inadequate and made a motion to Judge Barker to reconvene the next day with the jury at the Carver home, so that they would have a competent understanding of a description of the scene as presented by witnesses. To Burton's surprise, the defense concurred with his motion. Bell believed the jury would have a better picture of his client's claims of self-defense. At the Carver house the next morning, Dr. Mitchell pointed out how he had found Whitehead dead with his head in front of the bathroom door and his feet extended to an archway that opened to the hallway leading to Ruth's bedroom on their right and the defendant's on the left. In Ruth's bedroom, which was a master bedroom on the northeast corner of the house, Mitchell described how he had found Lee and Ruth on the floor between the front of the bed and a vanity desk against the wall. Over the next several days, Burton called 12 witnesses whose testimony helped him weave together the circumstantial evidence. The foundation of his argument was Carver's blood-stained shirt and the lack of blood splatter on Whitehead's shirt. He also built suspicion around Carver's washing himself over the kitchen sink and a witness account of stains that looked like blood spots on Carver's golf knickers. Bell countered the state's case with 20 depositions and 27 witnesses. His first witness was Sebring Police Chief Richard Stivender, who described the scene, as well as the moment when he heard Carver sob, "I'm sorry I did it. So sorry I did it." Bell would get to the bottom of that statement later. The remainder of that first day of the defense's case was to call 13 character witnesses and read to the jury 18 depositions attesting to William Carver's good character. 9 of the character witnesses were from Miami, and all the depositions were taken from people in Pennsylvania who knew the couple. All of the character witnesses and the depositions stated that Carver's reputation was excellent and that he was known as a kind and considerate father and husband, reported the Palm Beach Post. Several of the witnesses testified they had known Carver for as long as 10 years, while others referred to him and his late wife as the happiest couple they ever saw. All of them said they never heard him say an unkind word either to his wife or children, and that he was particularly fond of his small son, Lee. Over the objection of the state, Bell called Emmanuel Allsmeyer to relate a conversation he had with Ruth Carver on the morning before the incident. She told him that the day before the tragedy, Whitehead had made for me, or went for me, as if he wanted to attack her. "I'm afraid of that Negro," she added. As the two were talking, Allsmeyer said Whitehead was staring at Mrs. Carver as he stood 20 feet away, leaning on a hoe near a flower bed. On Saturday, May 17th, the second day of the defense's case, Carver's landlord, Tom Mitchell, testified that Carver seemed genuinely distraught over the loss of his wife and baby. "I can't see why I should have all this," Mitchell quoted Carver as having said. "I wish I had got mine over there while I was in the army. I've been through hell once and now have nothing to live for." Mitchell said he told Carver, "You have your daughter to live for." Larry Whitener, another black yard man who worked for Tom Mitchell, testified that the day before the murders, Ben Whitehead was nursing a hangover. "He acted peculiar and had a sullen look about him," Whitener testified. Mitchell's friend, Lewis Evers, told the court he stopped by the house on the day of the murders to borrow some fishing poles, and he spoke briefly with Mrs. Carver, who he said seemed nervous. "Oh, I'm so glad you are here," she told him. She never explained why she was glad he was there, and since he didn't know her that well, he did not engage her in a conversation. But the highlight of Saturday's testimony was when Ray Carver took the stand to tell his story. Although he started out appearing calm and composed, throughout his 1 hour and 15 minutes of testimony, he was overcome by grief, and the tenor of his voice rose as he fought to get his words out. On the day of the murder, he had played golf that morning. When he returned around noon, the family had lunch before lying down to take a nap. Before he went to his own bedroom, Carver said he told Whitehead to wash the dishes and then mop the bathroom and kitchen. "I went into my bedroom to take a nap," Carver said, "and was suddenly awakened by screams. I ran into her bedroom and... oh, dear, there was my wife and boy." Carver broke down and sobbed and covered his eyes with his hand. It took him an entire minute to recover and resume his story. When he looked in the bedroom, he saw Whitehead with something in his hand, but he did not see him hacking his wife and son with the hatchet. He then ran back to his bedroom, grabbed his small revolver, and fired at Whitehead, who was coming at him down the hallway. He staggered backward but did not fall until Carver was out of bullets. "When I shot, he screamed, and I shot him until he fell down," Carver told the jury. "Then I saw he might get up again, and I wanted to kill him, the dirty skunk, as any other white man would do." At this point, Carver once again broke into tears. When he continued, he said he ran back into his bedroom to reload his pistol, and he shot Whitehead again as he lay on the floor. He then rushed into Ruth's bedroom, where he saw his wife and son with their heads bloodied by the sock-covered hatchet. At that point, Carver again broke down. His voice, which in the early part of his testimony had been low but distinct, now rose to a shrill falsetto as he tried to continue while struggling against his emotion. His face was distorted, and beads of perspiration stood out noticeably on his forehead, an Associated Press report revealed. Seeing that his wife was still alive but unconscious, Carver said he got a towel and wrapped it around his little boy's head. Then he telephoned for police, a physician, and his neighbor, Mrs. Lewis Allsmeyer, who did everything she could to console him after the police arrived. He admitted he couldn't remember much about what had occurred in the house when everyone was there. His memory was foggy. "Mr. Carver, did you kill your wife and child?" Bell asked him. "No, sir," he replied loudly. "It was that dirty skunk of a Negro." He then repeated to the jury that when he went to his wife's bedroom, Whitehead had something in his hand and started after him. "I don't know what it was," he said, "but I know he was after me, and he had done something to my wife, and I had to get my gun." When he met Whitehead in the hall, he started shooting at him, and Whitehead threw up his hands and screamed like a wildcat. On redirect, Bell brought into evidence the life insurance policy and questioned Carver about it, who said his wife had signed up for it on her own accord. Taken out on December 13, 1929, the policy, with her signature, named her husband and both of her children as the beneficiaries. Bell also introduced into evidence checks Ruth had written from her personal bank account to pay the premiums herself. Bell continued by asking Carver what he meant when witnesses testified that he said, "I'm sorry I did it. So sorry I did it." Carver answered that he was sorry he took a nap while leaving Whitehead in the house unattended. Later that same day, Ruth's mother explained to the jury her daughter had a distinctive, high-pitched soprano voice. Earlier in the trial, state witnesses said the screams they heard could not be identified as male or female. If observers thought this was a barely relevant point, to Bell, it wasn't. It was meant to pick apart the state's theory that Carver shot Whitehead first and then bludgeoned his wife and son to death, and it was her screams that witnesses had heard. Instead, he wanted to show it was possible the screams had come from Whitehead. Monday saw more witnesses and rebuttal witnesses testify before closing arguments were presented on Tuesday, May 20th. As Bell reviewed Carver's character in the entire case over several hours, his key point, noted by observers, was that Carver was wealthy enough from his own real estate endeavors and would not have to do a thing like this for a paltry $10,000 life insurance policy. Bell also proposed a simple counterpoint to the prosecution's main argument. If this were, in fact, an elaborate scheme to collect $10,000, what did William have to gain by murdering his son? Why not wait until Ruth Carver was alone to stage the crime scene and shift blame to Whitehead? As for the blood on his shirt, it came when he inspected his wife and then aided his son by wrapping a towel around his head. State Prosecutor Burton closed with the assertion that Carver had planned the murder because his success had always been dependent on his father and wasn't his own. On April 2nd, he first shot Whitehead in the bathroom, which woke his wife, who grabbed her son and ran around to the front of the bed where Carver beat them to death with the hatchet. Then he fired several more shots to stage the crime. The 10-man jury deliberated all night long until the morning of May 21st, when they returned a guilty verdict with a recommendation of leniency. Carver grew pale when he heard the jury's decision, but he showed little emotion. His family, as well as Ruth's mother and brother, gathered round to comfort him as he sat back in his chair, stunned by the news. Outside, Ruth's mother continued to voice her support. "I know William is innocent. Nothing that could ever happen will convince me otherwise. My years of intimate knowledge of the married life of William Carver and my daughter give me a confidence which nothing can alter." Ruth's brother, Julius, was appalled by the verdict and could barely hold back his anger. "I have listened to every speck of evidence produced in this trial," he began as he stood outside the courthouse. "I have personally investigated the case. I loved my sister as much as any man in this world could love a sister, and I would be the first one to feel bitter toward her slayer. But I know beyond any shadow of doubt that Bill Carver is as innocent of that crime as I am, and I know that the evidence produced upon the witness stand was not sufficient to justify such a verdict. The plain fact remains that an innocent man has been condemned." Judge Barker delayed sentencing until after he had heard defense arguments for a new trial that were to be presented on June 9th. Carver, in the meantime, remained in the county jail awaiting the judge's decision. Not wanting to see his career-building case get away from him, prosecutor Grady Burton told reporters he would try Carver on the two still-open murder charges. But as June rolled into July, both sides waited as the judge reviewed the new trial motion. Most judgments on new trial motions come quickly, often the same day they are presented, but Judge Barker seemed to be considering the motion. Finally, on July 21st, Judge Barker denied the defense's motion for a new trial. 1 month later, on August 18th, nearly 3 months after the trial ended, Carver was brought to court to hear his sentence. Before doing so, he was asked if he had anything to say to the court. "Yes," he replied. "This sentence should not be pronounced. I swear before God and man that I am not guilty of this hideous crime." Taking up the jury's recommendation, Barker sentenced Carver to a life sentence in prison. Denied bail, Carver was allowed to stay in the Highlands County Jail as his attorneys appealed his case. In April 1931, the appeals court upheld the circuit court ruling. Undeterred, Carver's defense attorneys petitioned the state Supreme Court for a rehearing of the case, and to everyone's surprise, their request was granted. This ultimately resulted in a 3-2 decision for a new trial. With his second trial scheduled for March 1932, Carver's attorneys obtained a change of venue to DeSoto County. In a surprise move, defense attorney Bell subpoenaed Judge Barker as a defense witness, which forced the state to name Judge James Kuntz to preside over the case. He set Carver's bond at $15,000, and after serving 563 days in jail, Carver was released. Jury selection began on March 2nd. This time around, the press took no real interest in the case, and the top headlines during the 10 days of the second Carver case were for the missing baby, Charles Lindbergh, Jr. In his magazine article published later that year, prosecutor Grady Burton said his case was handicapped by the absence of two key witnesses. Sebring newspaper reporter Jack Cleaver had been killed in a car accident several months before, and Dr. John Mitchell lay dying in a Texas hospital. After Burton presented a shorter version of his case, Walter Bell put on an aggressive defense, which began with 2 days of testimony from witnesses who tore holes in the state's case. One of the central points in the second trial was the fact that witnesses had heard screaming. Defense expert Dr. L.W. Martin testified that the blows to Ruth Carver's head were so severe that they would have immediately rendered her unconscious. The scream Carver heard, which awakened him, likely occurred when Ruth woke to find Whitehead in her room stealing her jewelry. Ruth Carver's fears of Whitehead were also more thoroughly established in the second trial. It also came out that Carver was going to fire Whitehead later that day, and that the laborer may have known this. On the third day, Carver took the stand to tell his story again. "Did you kill your wife and baby?" Bell asked him. "No, I did not," Carver replied in a loud voice. "Who killed them?" "Ben Whitehead," Carver answered. "And did you kill Ben Whitehead?" Bell asked. "Yes, sir." Carver also testified that when he heard his wife scream, he ran into the room and saw his wife and child on the floor, and Whitehead had his arm raised and was holding some dark instrument. This time, the DeSoto County jury sided with Carver, and he was acquitted of his wife's murder. State Attorney Grady Burton dropped the two remaining charges against Carver. Epilogue to Chapter 3. According to a 2014 interview with William Carver's granddaughter, Carver's daughter Frances is still alive and 85 years old at the time of this writing. Frances passed on to her daughter the story of her life after her father was acquitted. "He told my mother that he was going to fire Ben Whitehead before the incident happened, and that he felt Ben was angry, and this was how he was going to pay them back," she recounted. "He was heartbroken and always said Ben Whitehead did it because he was disgruntled. My mom believed she was to be killed next." For reasons that are unclear, William Carver was ostracized from his own family, as well as Ruth's, after his acquittal. His ordeal and his estrangement from both families embittered him. She, his wife's mother, Ruth Staff Boardman, blamed him for what happened, because it happened, not because he did it, the granddaughter explained. With his name attached to a murder conviction, despite being later found innocent, and with employment opportunities made scarce by the Depression, William Carver left his daughter in Ruth's care as he wandered the United States looking for work. He did odd jobs and jobs that paid cash, and learned to use an alias because no one would hire William Raymond Carver from Sebring, Florida. When Frances was 5 or 6 years old, her father came back for her and brought her out to the Los Angeles area where he did odd jobs for the movie industry, sometimes working as an extra in films. He also did a little script writing and editing, but never received credit for his work. Frances never saw her grandmother again. Since neither family would have anything to do with William, their exclusion extended to his daughter, who became an innocent pawn in a grown-up's game of selfish bitterness. As hard as life was for William Carver, he made it even harder on Frances, who was forbidden to go to school until she was 10 years old. Her existence had to be kept a secret in order to keep William's secret that he was once convicted of a horrible murder. Mother had to stay at home, the granddaughter explained. She was not allowed to go outside. She was told to stay in the house, and nobody could know she was there. It was a lonely, sad time for Frances, who learned how to read and write from her father. At the age when other children have friends and play outside, Frances had to stay indoors and do all the housework. When she was 10, Frances was allowed to go to school, but was under strict orders to come home as soon as it had ended. When she was 12 or 13, she came home from school one day to find a note that said, "I can't take care of you anymore. Go live with the neighbors." It was a harsh way of telling his daughter he had cancer. He would be in and out of a Veterans Administration hospital for the rest of his life. When Frances was 17, William wrote to her requesting a visit. By then, she was living in Santa Monica, California, with a foster family that showered her with love and care. Despite her conflicted feelings, she was encouraged to visit her father by the man who would soon become her husband. Not long after that visit, William Carver died in Los Angeles on October 8, 1950. He was 59 years old. He was very depressed his entire life for losing his wife and child, the granddaughter learned from her mother. He didn't know what to do with himself. He was just going through the motions of life. At the age of 17, while living with her foster family in Santa Monica, Frances Carver worked in a Macy's department store as a clerk and store model. She married in 1949, and the couple had 2 boys and 2 girls, one of whom was interviewed for this story.